Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's three-day trip to Alaska, which is meant to highlight how much the United States is being affected by global warming and rising oceans, and go to Alaska to speak with Lois Epstein, the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She currently serves on the Ocean Energy and Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. We'll discuss Obama's mixed message of warning about global warming while allowing Shell Oil to drill in the Arctic. Then we'll examine what is behind the sentencing of the three Al Jazeera journalists by an Egyptian court that appears to be petty, cruel, and vindictive, and based on absurd charges and laughable evidence. An expert on the Arab media, Marwan Krady, the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture, and the Director for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us. We will discuss the sentencing of journalists for practicing journalism that has been widely condemned, and examine the broader issue of the many more victims of injustice in Egypt. Then finally, we'll examine the ugly violence that took place in front of the Ukrainian parliament, where members of the far-right nationalist Svoboda Party tossed smoke bombs, then grenades, into the crowd, killing one National Guardsman and wounding 122 others, 11 critically. Alexander Model, a professor of political science at Rutgers University and the author of The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929, joins us to discuss the difficulty Ukraine's President Poroshenko is having selling the Minsk Agreement to the country's restive pro-government paramilitary groups. And joining us now from Anchorage, Alaska, is Lois Epstein, who is the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She currently serves on the Ocean Energy and Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, and has testified before the House and the Senate on more than a dozen occasions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lois Epstein.
Oh, thanks very much, Ian.
And President Obama, I take it you saw him up close and personal there in Anchorage at a big rally that also was a demonstration. And I take it that it's one of those rare days in Anchorage where you actually see North America's tallest mountain, previously known as Mount McKinley, but now it's going to be called Denali, as the locals have always called it.
That's right. It's a very exciting day in Anchorage. There's a rally going on in support of President Obama's actions on climate change. There's a number of folks out there that are unhappy with the administration's decision to allow Arctic Ocean drilling by Shell this year. And then also the motorcade has come by. There are people lining the streets of Anchorage to welcome the president. There was a lot of excitement when he landed, I've been told, at the Air Force Base nearby. And so, Denali, it's not all that often that we get to see the peak so visible. It's a clear day here, it's a clear day there, and everywhere in between. And it was just perfect timing to have a beautiful day right after the mountain has been renamed by the president and Secretary Jewell.
So there were demonstrations, but these weren't diehard Republicans defenders of President McKinley, the president during the first Gilded Age, as opposed to the current Gilded Age.
Well, no one's protesting the renaming here in Alaska. Democrats, Republicans, independents, everybody's happy about that decision. I've been reading about some folks in Ohio that are not so happy, but I think the decision is absolutely welcomed here in Alaska.
So tell us about the demonstrators then that were sending a signal to the president that, frankly, I think you can make the case that the president is sending something of a mixed signal. On the one hand, he's warning the country about global warming and ocean rise, and at the same time, he's also allowing Shell to drill in the Arctic.
That's right. You know, the president has actually done a number of things associated with Alaska and the Arctic in recent years. He's paid quite a bit of attention to what's going on up there. Onshore, he's made some very good decisions recommending wilderness for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and in the poorly named National Petroleum Reserve, which actually doesn't have all that much petroleum and has some very sensitive wild areas, he's instituted some protections and allowed some areas to be open for oil development. On the offshore, however, where it's extremely risky, Shell had a disastrous drilling and mobilization in 2012. The president's allowed Arctic Ocean drilling to continue this year. Shell's up in the Arctic Ocean with an armada of ships. And, of course, if they find sufficient quantities of oil, when that's produced and used, it is going to exacerbate some of the problems the Arctic is and other places are experiencing from climate change.
Well, you have to add to that, though, this permission by the Obama administration for Shell to drill in this sensitive Arctic Ocean area off the coast of Alaska. It's a difficult undertaking. Apparently, they've brought up some new blowout preventer that's supposed to be the next generation. We know from what happened down in the Gulf of Mexico that that can be a catastrophe. But even if you believe in that new technology, my understanding is that to actually get the oil out, you would have to dig. Well, first of all, you can't put the pipeline from the rig to the shore, which may be well over 100 miles across the Arctic Sea, because when the ice breaks up every year, it churns up the bottom, scours the bottom. So this pipeline would have to be dug beneath the seabed. And to my mind, that's an amazingly expensive undertaking. Is there enough oil there to justify this, even just in terms of the economics of oil?
Based on what the U.S. Geological Survey knows, and there has not been a large number of wells that have given them the information they need, they think there could be a big reservoir, and that's why we're concerned in terms of the climate impacts associated with producing and using that oil. However, Shell's out there spending enormous amounts of money to determine whether, in fact, there is a big reservoir there or not. In 2012, they drilled a partial well. They got a little bit of data from that. They decided they weren't going to finish that well this summer. They're about 70 miles offshore. If that exploration resulted in their view, commercial quantities of oil, they would have to, as you said, build the pipeline from offshore to onshore. It would have to be under the seabed and basically designed in a way so that it wouldn't be scoured by very deep icebergs that do pass over those areas. And then once it hit the shore, it would have to go several hundred miles across extremely sensitive lands in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, and other parts of the state in order to reach the Trans-Alaska pipeline that exists now. So it would be an extremely, extremely expensive undertaking to move from exploration to production of this oil and then getting it to market.
And again, I'm speaking with Lois Epstein, who is in Anchorage, Alaska, where she's the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She currently serves on the Ocean Energy and Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement and has testified before the House and the Senate on more than a dozen occasions. So the president is obviously on his way. He's got a three-day trip there. He plans to hike on the glacier in Seward on Tuesday. And that, of course, would highlight how much the glaciers have receded because of global warming. And on Wednesday, he goes to this fishing village of Dillingham, which is famous for salmon fishing. And then it goes on to the Arctic Circle to the small town of Kotzebue. And I take it what he's trying to highlight in the Arctic Circle there is that these tiny little islands are disappearing. And I was reading a story about how the villagers can no longer bury their dead because of rising oceans. So what is the expected photo op going to be there?
Well, it's actually not just the islands that are eroding and faced with storm-associated erosion of the coastline. It's really vast stretches of the coastline of northern Alaska that are in trouble. There are villages along the coastline that are now being battered by storms that they used to not face, because what would happen is the ice would form near the shore in the fall, and then the storms would come. Now the storms are coming, and there is no protective ice barrier. So villages like Kivalina and Shishmaref, which Kivalina is near Kotzebue, is one where the infrastructure is more or less falling into the sea, and some of that is going to have to be relocated. Very expensive undertaking. Alaskans are familiar with those kinds of images of cemeteries and buildings that are on their side. Even melting permafrost means that roads and buildings in the interior, not just the coast, are facing the impacts of climate change. We know it's going to be very expensive to fix, and we're really hoping that what we have are strong measures by the U.S. and other countries, potentially in Paris, and this is going to be a visual for the public at large about the need for changes, so that the Paris meeting in late November, early December, there is an agreement to actually ensure reductions of greenhouse gas emissions, so that at least in the future, we're not going to have to face so many costly situations that need to be addressed here in Alaska and other places, of course.
So that you're referring, of course, to the International Climate Conference in Paris, and the president's obviously been leading up to that in terms of announcements that he's made. But give us a sense of what you saw today in Anchorage, Alaska, Lois, because I take it was a pretty colorful and rather festive occasion, both with people cheering the president on and a few people pulling him over.
Yeah, the protest against the administration's decision on Arctic Ocean drilling was very, very festive. It was very multicultural. There's broad concern. Even though Alaska depends quite a bit on oil development, though that is on state lands. The federal lands and waters are extra sensitive. There are reasons those areas belong to the federal government, to all Americans, and not just to Alaskans. So while there's significant support for resource development within Alaska, I would say there's far broader support to having that development taking place in the areas that are much less sensitive. There's also strong support for protecting the most special places. And that's why you saw a real cross-section of Alaskans at this protest against Arctic Ocean drilling.
So you had a polar bear, I take it?
There was a polar bear there. There was also a mock-up of a Shell drilling rig. It was called the Polar Profiteer.
But it wasn't a real polar bear, I take it?
It looked pretty real, but I don't think there are too many actual polar bears walking in downtown Anchorage.
Well, I would hope not. So,
occasionally we do see black bears, and I have seen one, and I live downtown near my house.
I see. So, but didn't the president meet with a bunch of local Native American leaders?
The plan is that today he will be meeting with some Alaska Native leaders. He will be addressing the Glacier Conference. The Glacier is the Global Leadership in the Arctic. It's a long acronym, and he'll be doing that later today. Secretary Kerry addressed the conference earlier today, and as you said, in the next 2 days, the president will be traveling throughout Alaska to look at how climate change is affecting the state and to talk to the people that are being affected.
So in terms of, I mentioned the mixed message. On the one hand, warning the country about the effects of global warming and sea level rise, and on the other hand, having allowed Shell to drill. Which is the stronger message here? What do you think is going to be the takeaway from this trip?
It's hard to know. They're both very actively discussed here. I've been talking to other reporters. Both topics come up simultaneously. So It's hard to say, but I think in general one of the big takeaways is that the Arctic is a very special place. It's very important to the country that we recognize that we are, in fact, something known as an Arctic nation. That's what other Arctic nations call themselves, whether it's Scandinavia or Canada. And there are 8 Arctic nations, and the U.S. is one of them. And there are some incredible natural wildlife and environments and ecosystems up there. Birds that migrate to the Arctic to breed, and then they go to 5 different continents from there. I don't think anybody wants to see that not be protected.
And that conference you mentioned that Secretary Kerry's at, that is all the foreign ministers, is there not, from Russia, from Sweden, Finland, Denmark, and Canada? 8 nations all told, actually.
There are 8 nations in the Arctic Council, which is a UN-like body, but the Glacier Conference is not an Arctic Council event. We are the chair for the next 2 years. That was by design. They wanted to allow countries like China and Korea to participate in this particular event in Anchorage, the idea being that we want all nations that are playing an important role associated with climate change to be at this conference. So it's not an Arctic Council sanctioned event, but it is connected in some fashion to the U.S. chairmanship of the Arctic Council.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lois Epstein.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Arctic.
And again, I've been speaking with Lois Epstein, who is in Anchorage, Alaska, where she's the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She currently serves on the Ocean Energy and Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, and has testified before the House and Senate on more than a dozen occasions. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining what's behind the sentencing of the 3 Al Jazeera journalists by an Egyptian court.
Now the deep water horizon descends down to the death's door, and at the bird's foot they've lost a home. 'Cause all the leaves are drifting for miles and miles, poisoning the Gulf of Mexico.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marwan Crady, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research on Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Crady.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And the sentencing of the 3 Al Jazeera journalists has been widely condemned throughout the world. And frankly, it's pretty hard to stomach. I mean, it just appears, in terms of the sentencing, to be petty, cruel, and vindictive, and obviously based on absurd charges and laughable evidence. I mean, essentially, these journalists are going to jail for practicing journalism. But why do you think the international condemnations are falling on deaf ears? Because you get mixed signals from General Sisi, who says he'd like to get out from under this. So you have to ask yourself, well, why did, if he controls the country, which he apparently does, why did he allow these judges to, you know, go ahead with this farce?
Well, you know, you have there's a deeper background to this, which is the kind of the death battle between the Egyptian government, headed by Mr. Sisi, and the Muslim Brotherhood. And whether we like it or not, Al Jazeera is quite sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood. And so even within the Egyptian revolution, even before Mr. Sisi came to power, its role in Egypt was controversial. And these journalists simply are, I think, a victim of this struggle between the Egyptian government and the Muslim Brotherhood. And clearly the charges are absolutely ludicrous. But, you know, this was not the first time this happens, right? There was an initial verdict in June of 2014, a little more than a year ago, and they were convicted for aiding a terrorist organization. This time around, terrorism was not central. It was still part of the verdict. But there were funny things like being basically evidence that they used Final Cut Pro, basic editing software, and that somehow undermined national security in Egypt. Things like one of the three was had a bullet casing with him, and he got 6 extra months. It does seem like a very contrived type of legal proceeding. But once you put it in a larger context, I think you understand a collision course between the Egyptian government and the Muslim Brotherhood. Al Jazeera is seen by the Egyptian government as an instrument of the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I think we have these three men who are paying the price for that.
So is it important then to make the distinction, Marwan, between the English language broadcasts of Al Jazeera and the Arab language broadcasts? In other words, the English language broadcasts are, you know, straightforward, objective journalism. A lot of BBC people seem to be in some of the top management of Al Jazeera English, and they bring with them that kind of professionalism. But my understanding is that Al Jazeera in Arabic is a little more, you know, biased, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, it's they're part of the same network. But the Arabic service, Arabic channel, is much closer to the agenda of the Qatari government, the main bankroller of Al Jazeera. Qatar was seen in the early stages of the Arab uprisings, was seen as one of the big winners because it supported the Muslim Brotherhood and other kind of middle of the road Islamists, you know, very conservative, but not the kind of avowed jihadis like Al Qaeda. And so you had Islamists getting to power, winning elections in Tunisia, in Egypt, and elsewhere. Then there was a shift with the so-called counter-revolution, where forces typically supported by other Gulf regimes, especially in particular Saudi Arabia, won the day. And as a result, you know, Al Jazeera went from being a very welcome force in Egyptian politics under the Brotherhood to being an outcast. And actually, you know, if the Muslim Brotherhood is public enemy number one, Al Jazeera became public enemy number two. Nowadays, there are a couple of things that exacerbate all this, which is the violent jihadi insurgency that the Egyptian government is facing in Sinai. And so one of the ways in which we can look at this, in October 2014, there was a big terrorist attack, and 33 soldiers died, in Egypt soldiers were killed in Sinai. And that began ratcheting up, a process of ratcheting up pressure on the media. So much so that the initially proposed anti-terrorism law basically weaponized the media. The media, media institutions and journalists were defined as potential enemies of the state because they could represent actions. They could represent, let's say, a terrorist attack, an explosion, an attack on the army in ways that counter the official narrative. And so there was a huge outcry about this. And the final text of the law basically says the same thing, that there are penalties levied on journalists that counter official narratives, state narratives of let's say terrorist events, but it changed from prison to very large fines. We're talking about fines that can reach up to $65,000 American dollars. And so this is one of the things that we can put in the context.
Again, I'm speaking with Marwan Crady, who's the Anthony Shadid Chair of Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life and Arab Television Industries. So there's a couple of issues here. One is, of course, that as we talk about three journalists, one of whom was let go to Australia, even though he was just sentenced. The other two weren't. One's an Egyptian and one's an Egyptian-Canadian citizen. There are many, many more people in jail under even crueler circumstances.
Absolutely.
And I don't think we should forget that. But since you brought up the Sinai, hasn't the Sinai been a sort of no man's land for a long time? There have been smugglers who have been kidnapping people and ransoming them. It's been a real mess. So is it just become a convenient target for international jihadis, including the Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State?
Yes, I think Sinai has been a mess for a while, but problems there were exacerbated by the rise of Daesh, the so-called Islamic State. And so you have groups in Sinai who claim to be affiliated or who have declared allegiance to the Islamic State, who are waging basically insurgency warfare on the Egyptian government. And we're talking about serious attacks. You know, 33 soldiers killed in October 2014, police stations attacked, checkpoints attacked, a lot of infrastructure attacks on pipelines, on electrical facilities. So the Egyptian government has been faced with this insurgency. And of course, you know, clamping down on an insurgency fueled the insurgency. So people who say that the Egyptian government is using this as an excuse to clamp down on the media are not completely wrong. They're not completely right either. And the bottom line is, right now in Egypt, the Egyptian government considers media reporting, independent journalism, as a threat. And this is a fact. They don't want anybody to counter the official narrative of how their counterinsurgency effort in Sinai are going. As a result, you know, you have a very difficult situation. Being a journalist in Egypt right now is very, very difficult. It's obviously not as difficult as being a journalist in Syria, where you risk imminent death at all times in certain regions, but it's still very difficult.
And what is the UN multinational force doing there in the Sinai?
I think I don't know for a fact. This is beyond my expertise. But they've been around for a very, very long time, and my sense is they're staying on the sidelines.
Yeah, no, that's my sense too. So, in terms of then the other question I had of how many people are in jail. We're talking about essentially two journalists who've just been railroaded by the government, but
yes,
an awful lot more that have been railroaded, particularly the members of the Muslim Brotherhood and the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood.
The membership of the Muslim Brotherhood and the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, journalists, bloggers, activists. There's one of an interesting thing happened a couple of days ago, which is a photojournalist known by the name of Shaltan, who was arrested and detained and put in jail by the government right when the so-called Rabi al-Adawiya demonstration, the pro-Muslim Brotherhood gathering at that square in Cairo in August 2013. He was basically, you know, the government, the police attacked, many people were killed. It was a massacre. And he was documenting this as a photojournalist. He was put in jail. He still hasn't been charged. And it has been 2 years that he has been in basically pre-trial detention. And legally, that's the limit. You cannot hold somebody for more than 2 years before trial. And so he just went on hunger strike. And one of the things that's coming out of all of this, you know, his lawyers are talking to some independent outlets, is that there seems to be, number one, the system in Egypt is overloaded with people in jail. The jails are full. And as a result, both you know, the jail infrastructure, but also the judiciary is completely overwhelmed by the process. And so it's only people who are very famous whose spaces go ahead. You know, we could talk about the free journalists, free Al Jazeera journalists, some of those. But the other thing that came out of since this photojournalist announced his hunger strike is that there seems to be a lack of coordination between different branches of the Egyptian government that are concerned with security issues. You know, the Interior Ministry, the National Security Agency, the military intelligence. There seems to be a lack of coordination, which could be what explains the mixed signals about what will happen to the journalists.
Well, it would seem, though, that if you go back before Tahrir Square and the revolution, which unfortunately has been sidelined and reversed, but, you know, prior to that, the military governments, for the longest time, had a huge infrastructure repression, didn't they? Because during the Tahrir Square, it was the police and the plainclothesmen in particular were the most despised people of all, and it looks like they've come back.
Absolutely, and you know the police day was there's a holiday celebrating the police was actually one of the crucial early days of the revolution where some of the biggest gatherings occurred, and so that's absolutely the case. But I think what we're seeing now is so hopes went very very high during the revolution in its wake, and now people are wondering when Egypt, especially Egyptian media, Egyptian journalism, when it will hit rock bottom. The question is there any chance of things improving, or is there not a chance of things improving? And one of the things you notice, actually, is so a trial like this, you know, you had the British ambassador made some comments critical of the verdict in Arabic. He was summoned by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and upgraded for that. But you see different treatment. So you have, you know, Mr. Gresty, the Australian journalist, he was deported. He's in Australia. He's outraged by the verdict, but he's free in his country. Mr. Fahmy, who's Egyptian but also Canadian, gave up his Egyptian citizenship in the hope that he would get deported. And he didn't get deported. The Canadian government made a very lukewarm statement about wishing that the Egyptian government would release him. And then you have this third one who's an Egyptian who actually got, on top of the 3 years in maximum security, he got an extra 6 months, and then he got a huge fine. So it's as if even the nationality determines how harshly you will be treated. It's as if in this case, even though the Egyptian government is claiming that, you know, when people criticize the verdict, when people criticize the courts, that's interference in Egyptian matters, that's a violation of Egyptian sovereignty. It seems that Egyptian citizens are getting, Egyptian journalists, are getting the brunt of the treatment, more so than foreign journalists.
Well, just in closing, much of the criticism one hears now leveled at the Obama administration and its Secretary Kerry for dealing with Sisi is, I guess, the idea that we've sort of returned to realpolitik after having flirted with idealism that came out of the Arab Spring. Is that the sad reality, that we just, the assumption amongst our security and foreign policy establishment is that Egypt's too serious to ignore, so we just have to tolerate Sisi?
It seems we are, and I think one of the biggest supporter of Sisi is obviously Saudi Arabia and the UAE. These are countries that are still reeling from the shock of the U.S. agreement with Iran, and I think regionally speaking, perhaps, that's where U.S. efforts are focused. Egypt is not on the front burner, so to speak. And it's, you know, whether this is good or bad, I think only the future can tell. You know, for all I know, there are some non-public channels going on, although I doubt it personally. Basically now, there could be an appeal. There's one last appeal that could happen with the cassation court, the appeals court. And then eventually it's up to the president to grant amnesty or not.
Well, but the other aspect, of course, would be when you mentioned Saudi Arabia being upset with the U.S., and so clearly is Israel upset with the Obama administration over the Iran deal. And, of course, Israel breathed a huge sigh of relief when Sisi came back into power and the Muslim Brotherhood was crushed, because Hamas is a creature of the Muslim Brotherhood, is it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Israel had the sigh of relief when Sisi came to power. It seems the border with the Rafah crossing now is under tighter control than it used to be. But I think regionally speaking, I think this is why perhaps foreign powers are not really interfering. I mean, one of the things that's going on right now, there's a reshuffling of the Iran deal, the U.S.-Iran deal, pushed main actors, important actors in the region, to recalculate, to recalibrate their strategies. And I think perhaps this buys Mr. Sisi a margin of maneuver right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Marwan Krady.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Marwan Krady, who is the Anthony Shadid Chair in Global Media, Politics and Culture and Director of the Project for Advanced Research in Global Communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an expert on Arab media and politics, and his books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the ugly violence that took place in front of the Ukrainian parliament. شبر الحكاية مواويل طرب بواقي الحب سوائي غضب قلوب مليا شجر الحكاية مواويل طرب وانا سامع I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Motel, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory. He's the author of many books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motel.
Thanks for having me.
And there was an outbreak of violence in front of Ukraine's parliament today in Kiev, where grenades were tossed, a National Guardsman was killed, over 100 people were injured in these protests over a bill that was passed to give the area in the east, where there is essentially a war going on through Russian proxies, to give more autonomy. And I take it that the nationalists in the crowd, members of Svoboda, the Freedom Party, and the Populist Radical Party, were the ones that were angry. So what's at stake here, and what kind of concessions were the parliamentarians making?
Well, it's all very complicated, because what actually happened in the Ukrainian parliament today was the passage by the parliament of the first reading, right? It was the first reading of proposed changes to the Constitution. For proposed changes to the Constitution to become constitutionally valid, over 300 parliamentarians must support them. At this particular vote, it was only something like 265, roughly, which is to say they gave themselves and the government the green light to proceed with further, with these constitutional changes. But the changes per se were not made. Now, what's entailed here? In the Minsk II Accords, which were signed over half a year ago, there is a clause that says that Ukraine will, amongst many other things, provide the regions, the separate regions, separatist regions, with some kind of special status. And now there's been an entire brouhaha over the last several months as to what that means. Russia wants special status to mean that these regions will have full-scale autonomy and will be able to influence Kiev in terms of its foreign policy, security policy, and so on. So Russia wants them, this region, to have as much autonomy as it can, so as to be able to permit the Kremlin to influence Kiev. Ukraine, of course, doesn't want that. That's the last thing Ukraine wants. At the same time, they're obligated to give these regions something resembling autonomy. So what Poroshenko and the government have done is they've developed an entire package regarding the decentralization of authority within Ukraine per se. What that means is that all sorts of communities, districts, counties, and so on will now have more authority over their own affairs and will also have greater budgetary authority. Within that package, there's also a statement saying that there will be passed a law regarding the temporarily occupied territories in the Donbass. Now, that law hasn't been passed, but of course it suggests that sometime in the future there might be such a law, and in any case, the Constitution, were it to, you know, were that particular passage to be adopted, the Constitution would then enable the government to pass such a law and to give these regions a certain degree of autonomy. Now, the radicals, the right-wingers who were protesting, they're opposed to any hint of autonomy because they see this as the beginning of the end of the dismemberment of Ukraine. Interestingly, Putin and the separatists also don't like the law. They think that it doesn't go far enough. And in the meantime, Poroshenko is saying, well, wait a second, this is just the first reading. We haven't given away the store. Everything now depends on how the separatists in Russia respond, because they too are obligated under Minsk II to adopt a variety of measures, including a ceasefire, which they violated from day one, including the withdrawal of light and heavy artillery, which they violated from day one, including the complete exchange of prisoners, which they've stalled on, including Russia's returning to Ukraine full sovereignty over its currently occupied borders. So what's ultimately going on here is a very complicated game. It's like simultaneous chess being played on, you know, five or six boards. And the larger game is Minsk II, and within that game, everybody is playing a particular game of its own.
Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Myrtle, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory. And he's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919-1929. But in terms of Ukrainian nationalism, this is a pretty ugly display. First of all, many of these young men who attacked the police in front of the parliament were almost as well equipped as the police. The Ukrainian Interior Minister has detained about 30 people, including a Svoboda member who's confessed to throwing the grenade, which injured 122 people who've been hospitalized, and 11 of them are in critical condition. The Interior Ministry has bitterly criticized Svoboda's leader, and you know they were throwing other explosive devices. They were also wearing these Svoboda T-shirts, and a policeman's leg was torn off below the knee, along with one that was killed. So that's a pretty ugly display. So what's going on in terms of nationalism, and how much does the state control? I understand there's a lot of nationalist militias out there. So what's the portrait you can give us of this right-wing nationalism in Ukraine?
Now, that's one of these stories that the Western media, for some reason, continually hype up. There are something like 2 to 3, let's call them extreme right-wing, or if you prefer, nationalist parties or groups in Ukraine. Svoboda is one of them, the so-called right sector is another one, and then there are a couple of very small ones which don't really matter too much. In total, they number several thousand individuals. Their electoral vote, the vote, you know, the share of the votes that they've gotten in past elections is barely 1-1.5%. So we're talking about very small fringe groups that don't have any influence on the larger political process, and that don't have any influence on sort of middle range politics as well, and for that matter, even lower range politics. In earlier elections, Svoboda was able to capture some district seats in western Ukraine, but within a year of capturing these seats and controlling the political process at the level of a couple of towns, they discredited themselves as being highly incompetent, loudmouths who turned out to be even more corrupt than the people they claimed to be replacing. So let's get that straight. We're talking about a fringe phenomenon. Now, that said, you're absolutely right. The people who were present at the parliament were primarily, not exclusively, but primarily members of the Svoboda Party. They clearly engaged in extremism. Throwing grenades is certainly no way to express one's political opinion. They were also throwing some kind of smoke bombs and things like that. And the fact that that one police officer was killed and something like 100 others were wounded is clearly, now I'm not sure if it's an atrocity, but it's clearly a crime. And it's pretty clear, at least according to their statements, statements of the Prime Minister, the President, the Interior Minister, and a number of other highly placed politicians and intellectuals, that they will be held accountable for this. Why do they engage in this? I mean, for one reason, of course, is they genuinely oppose giving any kind of hint of autonomy to these regions. But I think what's also important is that they came out to protest precisely because they are a fringe group. They're a fringe group that's finally found an issue that resonates with other parts of the population. So they came out in force and hoped, I think, to be able to assert themselves and to reacquire some degree of support within the population. In effect, though, what's going to happen is that they will simply discredit themselves because the government has no choice but to crack down. It will at least have to arrest and prosecute that one individual, the grenade thrower. It's likely to prosecute others as well who were involved in this conspiracy, and it's likely to be a conspiracy. And that could very well lead to a further diminution of this particular party's popular support, which, as I said, is very, very marginal.
So when the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, said that the violence was a stab in the back, what's he mean there? Because I'm assuming that state television in Russia, Putin's propaganda machine, will play this up to the hilt, because that's been their narrative all along, that they're not fighting Ukrainians. And I mean, it's a bit of a joke to think that anybody somehow can't see the obvious, that it's not Ukraine that's invading Russia, but Russia that's invading Ukraine. But still, we live in alternative universes here, and a lot of our listeners actually watch RTV and believe what they see on RTV. So there's no question that the Russians have a very skillful propaganda machine, and this seems to me to be a complete gift to them.
Oh, it's terrible, of course. I mean, in terms of Ukraine's image, I mean, it reinforces this notion that there are these crazy nationalist fascists who are throwing bombs and grenades throughout the country, even though, as I said, I mean, there's almost no evidence for this kind of larger behavior. Nevertheless, there you go. If this is the sort of thing you believe in, this is the sort of thing you want to propagate, as Putin obviously wants to do, this is simply a gift. What Poroshenko has in mind, however, is that what he is trying to do with these constitutional reforms is to resolve as peacefully as possible the deadlock or the conflict, the war that's currently taking place in eastern Ukraine. And he's doing this, as of course everybody knows, in conjunction with the United States, France, and Germany. I mean, these three key Western powers have been very supportive and have been indeed insistent that Ukraine adopt decentralization in some form of special status for these regions. And Poroshenko understands that he needs the support of the West in order to be able to attain any kind of reasonable solution to the Donbass war with Russia. I mean, Ukraine on its own simply can't do it. It needs the West. So hence, in undermining the accords, in engaging in violence, in providing Putin and RTV with this propaganda bonanza, Svoboda, or more specifically this individual and his cohorts and his colleagues, were obviously, as it were, stabbing the country, certainly stabbing the government in the back, which is to say that Ukrainians were turning against Ukrainians, as opposed to understanding that the real problem, the real enemy, lies further east and not in Kiev.
So in terms of the country's failing economy, that seems to be where the country is most vulnerable. And my understanding is that there's also, in terms of what's going on in Europe now, we're very much, you know, watching these hideous immigration flows and, you know, 71 bodies inside a truck, et cetera, like that. I mean, it's just a horrible picture. But in covering that yesterday, I was told that there are also refugees now leaving Ukraine for Poland. So are Ukrainians concerned about their country's future? And are they leaving?
Well, there are several questions here. I mean, Ukrainians, there's been estimated that there are something like 3 to 4, possibly even 5 million Ukrainians abroad. And they've been, you know, some of them are there, that's to say, mostly in Western Europe, partly in the United States, and some other countries as well. Most of them are migrant laborers. They go abroad, they try to get jobs, and very often they shuttle back and forth. Some go and study, some try to leave. But in any case, there's a fairly significant portion of the population that is living semi-permanently or more or less permanently abroad. Now, within the last half year or so, there has been a greater number of individuals applying for either asylum or some form of residency, especially in places like Poland. It's easiest in Poland, partly because Poles are very sympathetic to Ukrainians, but also because if you can prove that you have some kind of Polish ancestor, you can acquire the right to residency in Poland. So that's kind of the way in. So clearly that's taking place, and obviously the longer the war takes place, the more likely such kinds, you know, these immigration or attempts at immigration will take place. The actual bit of good news is the economy. I mean, surprisingly enough, it's been estimated that, I mean, in 2014, Ukraine's economy shrank by about 7.5%. In 2015, thus far, it's supposed to shrink about 15%, which, of course, is enormous. However, it appears to be the case, at least according to the economists, that this shrinking is bottoming out. That is to say, and some of them actually even expect zero growth in the last quarter of 2015. Now, zero growth isn't good news, but it's great news if you've just been declining by 15%. It's also been suggested that there may actually be 1 or 2 percentage growth in 2016. So the economy, it may actually be on the mend. Now, in addition to that, Ukraine has reestablished its gold reserves. It just signed a deal with Western creditors about the $19 billion debt it has. So there's actually, you know, I wouldn't want to be overly optimistic about zero growth. But as I said, compared to where Ukraine was a few months ago or, say, a year ago, this is actually pretty good news.
So what percentage of Ukraine's population has recently migrated or asked for asylum? You mentioned 5 million.
Well, 5 million are the people who seem to be sort of living abroad in some form or other. But mind you, some are there to stay, some are there in the expectation that they will return. I know a number of people like that. Others shuttle back and forth depending on the season. So they'll pick grapes in Italy in the summer months, and then they return to Ukraine for the winter and the fall, you know, those sorts of things. But roughly speaking, it's supposed to be several million, and I've seen estimates of up to about 4 or 5, which is a lot, obviously. In recent times, I mean, I've seen estimates in the tens of thousands who emigrated or are trying to emigrate as a result of the war. And that makes sense. I mean, given the economic distress, given the war, many people are clearly looking for other options, and immigration, if it's at all possible, is certainly one of them.
Well, just in closing then, you talked about an economic turnaround from very dire trajectory to one that at least is, you know, reversing the downward slide. And just going back to the political situation, is that going to stabilize equally as the economy is?
Well, in principle, it should. But of course, people's expectations are very high. At the same time, lots of people are very angry. Lots of people, and we can see that from this particular demonstration. Even though Svoboda represents largely itself, I mean, there are very, very many Ukrainians who are angry with the government, who think that it's moving far too slowly and affecting reforms. By that, people really mean bringing justice. I mean, they're outraged by the fact that the former bigwigs are still around, that the oligarchs are still making money, things like that. The situation is, I mean, on the one hand, things are actually improving, I would say significantly. On the other hand, popular perceptions are clearly, well, not exactly diametrically opposed, but not exactly supportive of the actual objective reality. People sense that things are getting worse, although objectively, I think you can easily make the case that they're slowly, slowly getting better. What that means for the government is that it's got to do a better job either of bringing about change more quickly so that people palpably feel it, or communicating its intentions to the population. But this is a dangerous moment for the government, because it's doing things that it needs to do. It may not be doing them as quickly and as effectively as possible. That's probably true. But it is moving the country forward. And yet, the majority of the population thinks that the country is either moving backwards or not moving at all. So somehow or other, that perceptual, as it will, gap has to be breached, has to be closed, rather, by the government. This particular tragic event in front of the parliament may be a wake-up call. It may remind Ukrainians that if they pursue too radical a course, the logical consequence of that may be more grenades, and that would be destructive and tragic and suicidal for the country. But at the same time, it may remind the government that it has to get its act a little more together and bring more people on board in the reform process.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Alexander Motel.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Motel, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empire, and theory, and is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.